Good to see all of you this morning. If you would please open your Bibles to 2 Samuel. We're going to be discussing chapter 24, but we're also going to be backing up and discussing some things from chapter 21 as well. So open your Bibles to 2 Samuel, and let's prepare ourselves for our study. In our study, we're continuing to talk about King David, a man after God's own heart. But we know that King David's life was filled with a lot of problems, problems often of his own making. We know how that King David committed sin with Bathsheba, and the consequences were severe. We know that the prophet Nathan in chapter 12 told him that these consequences, many of which would arise within his own house, David would be involved in turmoil and battle for the rest of his days. We also might note in verses 10 through about verse 12 of the text, chapter 12, 2 Samuel chapter 12, that the sword would not depart from his house. In verse 11, he said, "Behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house." And we know that many of the problems that David had resulted even with his own children. We talked about Amnon, and how that he took Tamar, his sister, and raped her. We talked about how that Absalom, Amnon's brother, David's son, killed Amnon, and how that then Absalom ultimately attempted to take the kingdom away from his father and caused David to flee from the city of Jerusalem. And the battle ensued in Mahanaim. And then Absalom was killed. We've talked about how that David, his heart was deeply grieved because of the death of his son. And then how that Joab, the captain of his army, encouraged him that you're going to have to get past this or you'll lose the loyalty of the people. And that's chapter 19. Now in our study this morning, I want to talk with you a little bit about 2 Samuel chapter 24. Now granted, we're going to back up and cover some material in between, but if you go to 2 Samuel chapter 24 in your Bibles, we note that the anger of Jehovah was kindled against Israel, and he smote David, or moved rather David against them, saying, "Go number Israel and Judah." Joab in verse 3 said unto the king, "Now Jehovah thy God add unto the people, how many soever there may be, 100-fold, and may the eyes of my lord the king see it. But why doth my lord the king delight in this thing?" What David did was a bad thing. But we want to note that numbering the people in and of itself was not something that had not been done before. If you'll turn back to Numbers chapter 1, of course, we note the book of Numbers, and there's a reason for that. In the book of Numbers at Mount Sinai, about a year after they came up out of the land of Egypt, God instructed Moses to number the people. And we can read about that in Numbers chapter 1. We note that at the end of the 40-year period, just before they crossed over into the promised land, again, the people are numbered. Numbers chapter 26, beginning in verse 2. The bulk of that chapter discusses that and how many were of various ones. But the numbering of the people, just to have a tally, was not the thing that was wrong. What was it that caused God to be so upset with David in the numbering of the people in 2 Samuel chapter 24? Why was this a problem? All right. We see that, number one, God hadn't told him to. But we also note that God had promised to be with these people. Now, how many of them there were was beside the point. Turn, if you will, in your Bible to Leviticus chapter 26. In Leviticus chapter 26, a long time before, Leviticus chapter 26, the verses beginning at verse 3. Leviticus chapter 26, verse 3. The writer said, "If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give your rains in their season, and the land shall yield its increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. And your threshing shall reach unto the vintage, and the vintage shall reach unto the sowing time, and ye shall eat your bread to the full, and dwell in your land in safety. And I will give peace in the land, and ye shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. And I will cast evil beasts, or cause evil beasts to cease out of the land, neither shall the sword go through your land. Now I want to note here, was that dependent upon their numbers? Look at verse 12. And I will walk among you and will be your God, and ye shall be my people. I am Jehovah your God, who brought you forth out of the land of Egypt, that ye should not be their bondmen. And I have broken the bars of your yoke and made you go upright. Was that dependent upon their numbers? No, it was not. Further, you'll notice in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7. I don't have that one on the board. But Deuteronomy chapter 7, look beginning at verse 6. Moses said, "For thou art a holy people unto Jehovah thy God. Jehovah thy God hath chosen thee to be a people for his own possession above all peoples that are upon the face of the earth. Jehovah did not set his love upon you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any people. For ye were the fewest of all people, but because Jehovah loveth you, and because he would keep the oath which he sware unto your fathers, hath Jehovah brought you out with a mighty hand, and redeemed you out of the house of bondage from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt." Question, had that not been proven in the conquering of the land? When the Israelite army came into the land under the leadership of Joshua, was their victory dependent or contingent upon their numbers? Well, of course not. It was because of the blessings of God. God gave the land into their hand. Now, as you turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 14, 1 Samuel chapter 14, we noted that during the battles with the Philistines, and we've described the numbers of the Philistines, or the scriptures define the numbers of the Philistines as being as the sand of the seashore. You'll note in chapter 13 of 1 Samuel, they're described as 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. Now that would be frightening, wouldn't it, to face an army like that? But the Philistines presented constant threats to the people. But look at the attitude of Jonathan and his armor bearer in chapter 14. It says in verse 6 that Jonathan said unto the young men that bear his armor, "Come and let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that Jehovah will work for us, for there is no restraint to Jehovah to save by many or by few." What did Jonathan understand and his armor bearer about their victories? Was it dependent upon their numbers? If God was with them, then it didn't matter how many of them that there were. In this particular instance, when we read of this battle, how many were involved in it initially? Two. Jonathan and his armor bearer going up against the garrison of the Philistines. Now, that's not the issue then, is it? How many people do we have? Can we fight against this enemy? When David sought to number the people in chapter 24, what was the problem with that? Was it just simply an issue of taking a census of the people? That's exactly the problem. You see, it's a lack of faith in God's power to deliver these people. And perhaps we might even underscore pride on David's part. Look at how many are in my army. That's never been the issue. Numbers have never been the issue. Whether or not God blesses His people has been contingent, number one, upon the promise of God, and that conditioned upon the obedience of His people. Now what's happening here with David? Look, if you will, at the text of chapter 24 again. 2 Samuel chapter 24. You'll note that Joab tries to talk him out of it there in verse 3. But he's persistent. Verse 4, notwithstanding, the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the captains of the host. And Joab and the captain of the host went out from the presence of the king to number the people of Israel. Now, do they come up with a number? Oh, yes. Look at verse 8. It says, so when they had gone to and fro through all the land, they came to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. It takes a while to number these people, don't it? David?
It's kind of ironic. It shows you how quickly people can change. Because when we first read about David in the Scriptures, what do we find him doing? Did he count on an army behind him?
No.
No. It was just him and that big giant.
And slingshot.
And he put all his faith.
Faith in God. God will deliver him. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. God that delivered me out of the paw of the bear and out of the lion's mouth will deliver this Philistine into my hand. David said that. But now we find that he seems to be somewhat dependent upon the numbers that are in his army. Bruce? Yes, they were. And David's confidence needs to be in God. Joab, of course, goes and numbers the people, and he gives the number to David. Look at verse 9. How many were there in Israel? And I want to call that to your attention as well. The division between Israel and Judah. We've mentioned that before, and we need to underscore that, note that in your mind here in passing again, before that actual division under the kingship of Rehoboam becomes a reality. We see that there is kind of a background of that even here. But in Israel, how many were there? 800,000 valiant men that drew the sword. And in Judah, 500,000 men. He's got a sizable army. But then in verse 10, David's heart smote him. And he said, I have sinned greatly in that which I have done. And he calls upon God's forgiveness. But now I want you to underscore as well in your thinking that though forgiveness is extended, that doesn't remove temporal consequences. I think sometimes we get that all messed up in our thinking. We think that forgiveness means no consequences, no temporal consequences. And that's just not true. When you think of the prodigal son, an easy illustration in Luke chapter 15, who took his portion of the inheritance and then went into a far country and lived it up, when he finally came to himself and returned to his father, did he get his inheritance back? No. It's gone. Gone forever. Now we see evidence of that when the younger brother refuses to rejoice, but the father came out and entreated him, and he said, all that is mine is thine. Not going to be any more division of the inheritance. You see, that's already happened. The younger brother took his, lived it up, it's all gone. He won't get any more. What's left is yours. When you think of the people of Israel, this is a classic illustration, and I think that one that has application among God's people today. We need to think about it. In Ezra chapter 9 and chapter 10, just the mention of Ezra and Nehemiah should suggest to your mind a time frame. What is the time frame that we're discussing? The rebuilding. That's right, the rebuilding. Of course, Nehemiah rebuilt the walls. Haggai rebuilt the temple. We're talking about the restoration. The rebuilding in the land after the period of captivity. But as they have returned from captivity, Babylonian captivity, what is it that the people did that has to be undone? In Ezra chapter 9 and chapter 10, what did they do?
They brought their foreign wives with them.
They did. They've intermarried with these other nations of people, and God had been very specific telling them not to do that. Don't do that. Now, when they return to the land, they want to be right with the Lord. But what was one of the requirements of being right with the Lord? All right, they had to put away those foreign wives. Couldn't do that. Couldn't keep them, you see. Now, there's consequence. Another illustration. You recall when Saul of Tarsus became the Apostle Paul,
having been then arrested, making his defense, bring me down in the channels of Acts, Saul, the Apostle Paul, said, if I have done anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. Well, when we look back at Paul's life, had Paul committed any crimes?
Yes. Well, actually he didn't, but he caused others to commit crimes.
All right. But our point is, if he's done anything in violation of Roman law, is the point here that's to be established, that the penalty would be death, would Paul think then that those consequences would not occur to him because, you see, he's an apostle. He's a Christian. I don't have to die. Go back to Jesus on the cross. When you look at those that were crucified with him, two thieves. We often speak of the thief on the cross who rebuked the other thief. And Jesus commented to that man, this day thou shalt be with me in paradise. And of course we're all familiar with the debate that comes from that about the subject of baptism and whether or not the thief on the cross was required to be baptized and all of that. That's another point. We'll not cover that at this time, but what I want you to note is when Jesus said, this day thou shalt be with me in paradise, did the man have to suffer the civil consequences of being a thief? He still died. Yes. He had had to acknowledge that he had been a thief. He and the other man received their just reward. They were to die on the cross because they were thieves.
Did he say that?
Yes, sir, he did. But the fact that he was forgiven didn't mean he could escape the temporal consequence. Now, what David did was wrong. And there's going to be consequences. We saw that what David did with Bathsheba was wrong. But there were consequences. You know, I want us to observe just here that sometimes the consequences of our sin, though our sin be forgiven, those consequences may last a lifetime. They may last even beyond your lifetime to somebody else's lifetime.
It reminds me, I don't know who said it, it might have been you, illustration of a young man and how his father taught him the consequences of sin by nailing a nail in the closet door. And all those nails were in the door, and the son pleaded with him, you know, how do we get those nails out of there? And he did the things to get them out of there, but what was left? As a reminder, was those holes as a scar, like a sin, will leave a scar on.
That's right. Sometimes for a long, long time. And consequence, yes.
Have we considered 1 Chronicles 21, verses 1 through 8 matter?
Right, 1 Chronicles 21. No, we haven't gotten there yet. Remind me the verse.
Verse 1 through 8.
Okay. It says, Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. And David said unto Joab and to the princes of the people, go number Israel from Beersheba even to Dan. And bring me word that I may know the sum of them. And Joab said, Jehovah make his people 100 times as many as they are. But my lord the king, are they not all my lord's servants? Why doth my lord require this thing? Why will he be a cause of guilt unto Israel? Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab. Wherefore Joab departed and went throughout all Israel and came to Jerusalem. And Joab gave up the sum of the numbering of the people unto David, and all they of Israel were 1,000,000 and 100,000 men that drew a sword. And Judah was 430,000 men that drew sword. But Levi and Benjamin counted he not among them, for the king's word was abominable to Joab. And God was displeased with this thing, therefore he smote Israel. And David said unto God, I have sinned greatly in that I have done this, but now put away, I beseech thee, the iniquity of thy servant, for I have done very foolishly. several things in that. I'm not sure exactly specifically what you're referring to, but we know that, that Satan moved David to do this, an adversary, I believe, was Satan. In this instance, of course, in the text that we read in the Kings, God did that. And we talked, I think, a class or two ago about Pharaoh and how that Pharaoh hardened his own heart and how that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. We talked about that element. But yes, we see in this that the thing displeased God. And why? Okay, well, why? Why would that displease him?
That's what I was going to ask you. Ah!
Yeah. Well, my understanding of that, verse 6, is, but Levi and Benjamin counted he not among them, for the king's word was abominable to Joab, that Joab did not count them because he had done enough counting. This whole thing was distasteful to Joab. Joab, I think, understood the point that our victories are not dependent upon our numbers. And so he had counted enough. He didn't count Benjamin and Levi. My understanding of verse 7, that God was displeased with this thing, therefore he smote Israel, was not necessarily that the cause that Joab had not counted Levi and Benjamin, but that there had been any counting at all. God was not pleased that David had instructed Joab to take a census of the people, which raises again the question, why was God so upset about this? Was it just to have an accurate number of the people that was wrong? No. God himself had given instruction for that at least twice before. There's a problem here with David's confidence in God in battle. Why count the soldiers? Why do you feel it's necessary to have an accurate count of the soldiers unless you think somehow your victories are dependent upon your numbers? And that was not the problem. The problem was, doesn't matter how many soldiers you've got. If you've got only two, like Jonathan and his armor bearer, if you're doing what's right, God fights the battle for you, you see. And I think therein lies the problem. Maybe you have something, maybe additional to think about.
I just take it all into consideration. Yeah. I just want to hear that.
Yeah, I think that's thought-provoking to see what was wrong with this. It wasn't wrong just to have a number, but it certainly was wrong to place your confidence in that number.
It seems to me that all the other kings of the earth would be counting their soldiers.
Oh, yes.
And so this is David attempting to be like the other kings.
Well, yes.
His faith in his numbers instead of in God.
Yes, and the thing that becomes interesting to me is right upon the heels of obtaining a count, David said, I've sinned. I've done foolishly. Bruce? Oh yeah, we've got consequences in David's family because of the sin with Bathsheba. But yeah, we've got some new things that are coming up. David's getting old as a king, but these things just keep happening. And it makes me feel kind of, I don't know what the word is, but I hate to be critical of David because of the greatness of his kingship and the greatness of David himself. And we're going to later see some criticisms of Solomon. And when we look at the greatness of Solomon, it makes me feel bad to say, well, this wasn't right in Solomon's life. But the point is, greatness does not nullify the consequences of the sin or the gravity of the sin. What David did was wrong.
In this particular case between the kings, or between the 2 Samuel account and 1 Chronicles account, how do we account for the difference in the number?
Ah, I was hoping somebody wouldn't notice that. David?
It's a little bit different subject, but sort of on the same thing.
I'll come back to it.
When we read about the faithful in the Bible, they were by no means perfect. But yet, I kind of hesitate. see God's grace, when especially when you're mentioned in the faith chapter, all of them, Hebrews chapter 11.
Right, right. I think your first point there is one we need to underscore, and that is that these great men of faith were not perfect. They did some grave things, and we need to note that. But to get back to Randy's question, you're going to notice, we'll just throw this out so you can observe it, when you're comparing the accounts of the Kings and the Chronicles, you're going to see some discrepancies in several numbers. And those that I have read in trying to explain some of those, there are various explanations, but one that seems to surface every once in a while is that the copying of numbers can sometimes be very difficult. And so error in copies of manuscripts where there are numbers may contain some discrepancies. And that doesn't mean that we need to throw the Bible out, because what we have are not the original documents. What we have are copies. And to make some allowance for a scribal error in a number doesn't mean that there's error in the Bible. So we need to just make a mental note of that. You'll notice that quite a little bit in the reading of these accounts.
You'll say the commentator here in the Truth Commentary series has an interesting thing. In addition to mentioning the possible textual errors, but he says it's possible that the standing army that he already had of 288,000, which was 24,000 times 12 months, was added to the numbers in Chronicles, resulting in the figure of 800,000 plus 288,000, or 1,088,000, which rounded off would be 1,100,000. And then, of course, the number 500,000 is rounded off from the 470,000 in Chronicles. So it appears that the numbers in Chronicles could be a sort of a rounded off number,
yeah.
Whereas the number in the book that we're in,
yeah, Kings,
Second Samuel,
yeah.
is
Samuel. Yeah.
A more precise number, but doesn't include the standing army right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Now another thing that I've noticed is that we appear to be putting this whole thing on David. But the fact of the matter is, it appears that God is angry with Israel, the whole country, or the whole people. Because he's angry with Israel, and this commentator says it probably has to do something along the sense of what he was angry with the Gibeonites about just previous to this, is that he allowed Satan to tempt David to do this, to cause the people to be numbered. But the sin was against Israel, and that's why Israel had to pay it.
Yeah.
And so we think, well, 70,000 people died because David committed a sin. Well, yes, David committed a sin because he was tempted by Satan and fell to that, and then later on realized that he had committed a sin by doing this. But it appears that the initiation of this was God's anger with the nation of Israel.
Yeah. Well, that's true, and we're going to see that was what was said in terms of consequence a long time before,
yeah.
That these consequences would be imposed upon the nation. Yeah. More on that. Yes, Eve?
We're looking for that verse that says that God won't allow one jot or one tittle of his word to disappear or to vanish. So obviously he's given us what we need.
Oh, yes.
You can say, you can try to make all these arguments that, maybe it's not exactly what was originally there, but he says he's not going to allow that to happen. So obviously, his word is not going to disappear. He's going to make sure we have what we need.
Absolutely.
To really follow his word.
Absolutely. Not one thing is going to pass away. You're good. Thank you. You just pinged that right off the top of your head, didn't you?
Of course.
Oh, absolutely. That's good. I had to chuckle. Well, let's get back to the text. 2 Samuel 24. In 2 Samuel 24, as a consequence of David's sin, God, through Gad, said to David, verse 13 is where we are, 2 Samuel 24.
Shall 7 years of famine come unto thee in thy land, or wilt thou flee 3 months before thy foes while they pursue thee, or shall there be 3 days pestilence in the land? Now advise thee and consider what answer I shall return to him that sent me. And David said unto Gad, I am in a great strait. Let us fall now into the hand of Jehovah, for his mercies are great, and let me not fall into the hand of man. So we learn that David makes a choice. 3 days pestilence. You might say, well, we'll hurry up and get that over with. Yeah, okay. 3 days pestilence. What did it mean? Richard just pointed that out to us. Not ready to go there yet. What did it mean to him? 3 days pestilence.
70,000 men died.
70,000 people of Israel died. From Dan to Beersheba, verse 15 tells us. We don't know what the pestilence was, but we've seen use of such plague or pestilence in times gone by. You recall in our study earlier, turning back to Numbers chapter 16, I think. Yes, Numbers chapter 16. Numbers chapter 16. We note in the context of chapter 16, we have read of the prophets of, or the men rather, of Korah, those who have followed him, 250 of them. The earth opened up and swallowed them. And then the people complained the very next day, verse 41. They murmured against Moses and against Aaron. And how many died as a result of that plague from the time that it started till the time that a sacrifice could be prepared, that is, burn incense and stand between the plague and the people and stop it? 14,700 people. Nearly 15,000 people died. Does that get your attention? And now here we see that within 3 days' time, 70,000 people die. That ought to get our attention. And God said then, it is enough, before the angel stretched out his hand against Jerusalem.
You notice that this is not an unusual occurrence, that the angel or the destroyer is about to destroy additional when God says, okay, that's fine. So he sent this angel, this destroyer out to do something. He did that when the people were in the wilderness wandering. And he did that, essentially with the Israelites and the Egyptians in Egypt. And now he's done it here. He sent out this destroyer.
All right.
And this destroyer is just going to ravage everything.
Yes.
Until God stops him.
Yes. And I want you to think, all of you, about how many die at the hand of one angel or destroyer? We've talked about in lessons gone by Hezekiah and how that the Assyrian king Sennacherib wanted to destroy the city of Jerusalem and threatened the next day. He had his army all ready to go, and 185,000, as I like to use the expression, of the Assyrian army woke up dead. 185,000. I preached on that one time. This would make a good sermon for you, Randy, to just go back and do the research on all these instances that we see one angel used by the hand of God to destroy masses of people at one instant. And then consider that when Jesus stood before Pilate, and Pilate made the remark, don't you know that I have the power to release you or I have the power to kill you? And Jesus said, don't you know that I have at my disposal 12 legions of angels? You wouldn't have any power at all if it were not for my Father. Now you let that hit bottom. You look at the thousands that died is that quick at the hand of an angel. And Jesus said, I command 12 legions of angels. you think you can do something to me?
And to end up that sermon, we just go over to the book of Revelation, look at the four horsemen and look at the seven angels and the trumpets and such like as that. How powerful God is in ending the whole shooting match.
Yeah. You taking notes, Randy? There's your outline. There's the conclusion. All right. Okay. Any other questions or comments while we're paused just here? All right, let's go back to our text. I want to back up, if you will, before we complete the text of chapter 24, the sacrifice, the offering at the threshing floor of Arona. But I want to back up in the text to chapter 21. Chapter 21. Toward the latter part of chapter 21 is the point of emphasis I want us to see. Here we still have David as an old man and battles ongoing. I mean, David's been king for a long time. And in verse 15, he's fighting still against the Philistines. In chapter 18, he's fighting against the Philistines. In chapter 19, war again with the Philistines. Verse 20, there was again war at Gath. Of course, we're introduced here to this large man that has six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot. But we note that, again, the opposition of the Philistines is very real. Now, when you come to chapter 22, chapter 22 and chapter 23, to a great degree, we read what some have referred to as Psalms that David wrote that are not contained in the book of Psalms. And this particular one in Psalms chapter 22 begins, "And David spake unto Jehovah the words of this song in the day that Jehovah delivered him out of the hand of his enemies and out of the hand of Saul." Now, it's very tempting to take the time just to read this in its entirety. I would really challenge you to do that. I'd like for you to do that. But to the point that I want us to see in our history and geography study, as it were, what is this song about? What's David saying? Of course, he's covering the period of his time as king, going all the way back even to the time when Saul was chasing him from place to place to place. What's this psalm about?
Is it a psalm of victory?
It is. It's a psalm of victory. We note that God had delivered him out of all of his enemies, and we see him praising God time and time and time and time again throughout this psalm for the victories that God has given unto him. Now, when you turn the page to the 23rd chapter, the 23rd chapter, I want to call your attention to what is referred to in verse 1 as the last words of David. And as you read this portion of this psalm, it says, "And the man who was raised on high saith, the anointed of the God of Jacob, and the sweet psalmist of Israel, the Spirit of Jehovah spake by me, and his word was upon my tongue. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spake to me, one that ruleth over men righteously, that ruleth in the fear of God. He shall be as the light of the morning with the sun rising, a morning without clouds, when the tender grass springeth out of the earth through clear shining after rain. Verily my house is not so with God. Yet he hath made with me an everlasting covenant." Now pay close attention here. "Ordered in all things and sure. For it is all my salvation and all my desire, although he maketh it not to grow. But the ungodly," some translations use the word Belial, "shall be all of them as thorns to be thrust away, because they cannot be taken with the hand. But the man that toucheth them must be armed with iron and the staff of a spear, and they shall be utterly burned with fire in their place. These are the names then of the mighty men," and we'll pause just there. But the thing that I want to focus our attention on here is not only do we have a psalm of praise, but we have specific mention of one element in particular of what David is praising God for. Look, if you will, at verse 5. Verily my house is not so with God, yet he hath made with me an everlasting covenant, ordering in all things and sure, for it is all my salvation and all my desire, although he maketh it not to grow. What is David speaking of? God has made an everlasting covenant. What was it? It is. It is. And you'll notice on the board, 2 Samuel 7. You remember in our discussion of 2 Samuel chapter 7, God makes reference to the seed of David. He shall build for me a house. I will establish thy throne, he said, forever. Now we noted in connection with that, that yes, Solomon, we'll talk about that more, was to build the temple in the city of Jerusalem. But there's much more said to David than just your son will build me a temple in Jerusalem. I will establish your house. What was it that was established? I will establish thy throne forever. What was established?
An everlasting kingdom.
An everlasting kingdom. That's right. Yes, Daniel spoke of it. But specifically here in speaking in 2 Samuel chapter 7, and I'm confident in this verse 5 that we're looking at here of this text, David has reference to the promise that God made that through his lineage, that is one of his seed, would sit upon his throne at the right hand of God. And it would not matter then what nationality people were of. They could be citizens in his kingdom. And David is thankful for that, as we see expressed here in 2 Samuel chapter 23. Now we talked about all that in previous studies. We'll not reiterate all of that. We know that that was referred to in Acts chapter 2. We know that David reiterated it again in the Psalms, in Psalms chapter 110, Psalms chapter 89, Psalms chapter 16. Psalms, well, all of these quoted in Acts chapter 2, or alluded to, and fulfilled in Christ, when he was seated at the right hand of God. David has reason to be thankful to God and to praise God for that here in this psalm of 2 Samuel chapter 3. And I simply want to make note of that in passing. When we look at the lineage of David, we might go back and account for the kings that reigned up until the time of Coniah, and then, of course, the period of the captivity. But we know that the lineage, according to Matthew, is described and continues right on down through Christ. Go ahead.
Just going to point out the prophecy that there would be a king on his throne, the kingdom would last forever. That was fulfilled in Christ.
Yes.
The kingdom itself was fulfilled in the church.
That's exactly right. That's right. The church is the body over which Christ is the head, the king of the kingdom, the head of the body. We see those analogies used frequently in the text. That's right. Now, picking up the thought there again in 2 Samuel, we see identified David's mighty men. And you'll note the parallel account of the Chronicles in 1 Chronicles chapter 11 and again in chapter 20. What's the significance of these mighty men? Now, I know you've gone through this text and you've read all of this. Are you impressed with what these guys did? Well, we need to be. When you think about men like Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man, Kabzeel, who had done mighty deeds. He slew the two sons of Ariel of Moab and went down, this is verse 20 of chapter 23, went down also and slew a lion in the midst of a pit in the time of snow, and he slew an Egyptian, a goodly man, and the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, but he went down to him with a staff and plucked the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and slew him with his own spear. These things did Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and had
a name among three mighty men. And he was more noble than the 30, but he attained not to the first three. Well, that kind of makes you ponder the first three, don't it? Here's a mighty man, but he wasn't as mighty as the first three. When you go back and read beginning in verse 13 of the things that they did, how that they whipped up on the enemies, the Philistines, in great numbers. And I would encourage you to go back and read carefully about these mighty men. Yes.
Especially verse 39.
Yes, especially verse 39. Verse 39 says Uriah the Hittite, 30 and 7 in all. Especially this verse, because when you turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 11, 2 Samuel chapter 11, and read about David's sin with Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite, David didn't just call back someone that was an ordinary soldier. He had not betrayed someone that was just an ordinary soldier, and I don't mean to make light of that. But in taking the wife of Uriah the Hittite, he's taken the wife of one of his mighty men. Do you see that? One of the great soldiers in battle, a great warrior. And David has committed this sin against him. That's an interesting observation. And you need to note that just in passing. Uriah is mentioned in this list of men. Okay? Any other questions or comments just here? All right, this leaves our study for right now. We'll come back to it from the account of 2 Samuel. But I want to jump over to the account, the parallel in the Chronicles. You know, when we look at 2 Samuel, it pretty well concludes in 2 Samuel chapter 24 with the offering of the sacrifice on the threshing floor of Arona. But the Chronicles gives us a whole lot more detail about the older life of David than what we see in the account there of Samuel. If you'll turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 22, 1 Chronicles chapter 22, you'll note beginning in verse 2, rather lengthy text going on through into the 23rd chapter, how that David makes preparation for the building of the temple. Now you'll note that it was David who first made the proposition to the Lord that he wanted to build the temple. And of course David couldn't do that. The Lord wouldn't allow him to do that. We find in this account that he had shed blood abundantly, verse 8, and therefore was not allowed to do that. But he makes preparation for the building of the temple. He organizes the people. He begins to pile up silver and gold and various things that are necessary to the building of the temple. And I'm out of time, but read there in the Chronicles and see how much provisions David has made for his son Solomon to take and build the temple of the Lord in the city of Jerusalem. I think you'll be impressed. Okay? Then we'll talk about the threshing floor of Arona. You might also note, while I'm paused there in 1 Chronicles 28, that it was David who gave Solomon the pattern for the building of the temple. So who drew up the blueprints? Well, yeah. But through David, all right?